This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you. Welcome you back if you attended last night's interesting session, and welcome you this morning if you're a new audience to a conference or a workshop, actually, a kind of work in progress, if you will, on synesthesia in the arts, religion, and cognitive neuroscience. Before I start, I'd like to welcome a special guest this morning, Sarah Takagaki, who is here from Palms Middle School in Los Angeles. Sarah, do you want to stand up? She's doing a project on synesthesia, and she's here to listen and learn and to interview some of the speakers. My name is Jeanette Peterson, and I'm in the Department of History of Art and Architecture here at UCSB. I'd like to begin by making some very brief introductory comments before I introduce our two speakers this morning. My comments reflect back on last night's informative and lively session on the mystical traditions of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. At least in the example cited in that discourse, it appears that Judaism has the clearest and perhaps the only example of what our glossary has identified as authentic or perceptual synesthesia. On the other hand, there appear to be multiple examples of, in a frequently used phrase, synesthetic language to describe mystical experiences, in the rare instances where such personal accounts exist. In this latter, less scientifically based, discursive synesthesia, multiple sensory modes are called upon as metaphors for an ineffable and holistic experience of the divine that, while imagined or confined to the inner senses, are nonetheless very real and described in somatic terms. Curiously, one of the goals of this interdisciplinary conference is somewhat self-contradictory. On the one hand, we seek to sharpen our distinctions between these various synesthetic states or experiences, and on the other hand, to come up with a more inclusive understanding of phenomena that appear to have great variety. Dangers exist on both ends. In our academic zeal to parse and categorize, we may so deconstruct synesthesia that we fail to appreciate the broad spectrum of experiences it encompasses. Heeding the siren call of synesthesia, we may also so homogenize its great variety that we fall into the trap of careless and irresponsible scholarship. I like Professor McGinn's comment last night that linked the single sensorium model with the model that distinguished between inner and outer senses, both of which existed as points on a spectrum. This morning's session on synesthesia and the arts will provide us with another line of inquiry, moving away from text-based evidence to what art historians use as their primary evidentiary documentation, that is, objects and visual culture. And here I'd like to acknowledge that there is a lack of representation of all the arts, many of which do have true synesthetic experiences. That is, we don't have music represented or the literary arts or individuals from theater and drama. All of the arts, of course, have a powerful affective power. That's a redundancy, I recognize. I wrote this early this morning. Thus, we too need to heed the wise admonition not to prematurely label as synesthetic the responses of touch or smell or taste based on what is provoked visually or orally by a work of art. According to Ramachandran's studies, among bona fide synesthetes, there are 8 times as many in this pool individuals who are involved in creative activities. This is somewhat tautological in a sense because these individuals may be creative because of their facility or propensity for synesthetic experiences. Finally, we need to keep in mind that we are trying to measure or assess two very different phenomena in the arts. One is the creative author, poet, musician, or painter, herself or himself. The other is the reception and impact of these works of art, a much more difficult but not impossible task. We are lucky this morning to have two very different, but I think equally provocative speakers. And the first will be Becerra Pencheva, who's an assistant professor at Stanford University. Becerra received her PhD from Harvard University, and impressively, that dissertation has already come out as a book in 2006 called Icons and Power, The Mother of God in Byzantium, Pennsylvania State University Press. Before she comes to the podium, I'd just like to mention another very impressive facet of Becerra's interesting work, and that is that she is fluent in many languages, not only her native Bulgarian, but English. She also speaks Italian, German, has a moderate speaking knowledge of French, modern Greek, and Russian, and can read ancient Greek, Latin, and Old Church Slavonic. I'd like to welcome Becerra to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I feel honored to be here, and I am swimming now with ideas, new ideas, both from yesterday's session and then coming back to my room and doing the finishing touches on the talk. So, I want to make sure that I'm performing according to all our technical people at the back. Do I do everything correctly before I start? The title of my talk is Smell and Sight in the Experience of the Byzantine Icon. And I'm showing you a map of the Byzantine Empire at the time of its greatest expansion of Justinian. But most of the talk is actually focused on Syria. And so if you can locate on the map Antioch, it's on the far right, and it is above Jerusalem and Damascus. So this is one center I'll be talking about, and the other center is Constantinople, and as well as Jerusalem. So now I've oriented you on this map, and that's where we'll dwell for the rest of the time. Christianity is a religion of the incarnate God. The Logos empties itself out in the flesh, sanctifying matter and exposing the senses as channels for the experience of the divine. In response to this incarnate God, early Christian religious experience mobilized the senses. Holy Land developed as a massive pilgrimage site in the course of the first century. Here, pilgrims came to see and touch places where Christ resided while on earth. Elaborate rituals fostered the enactment of sacred events in which the pilgrims could physically plunge in the cycle of Christ's life and become witnesses to his miracles and passion. My choice of words is deliberate here. Miraculum is from mirare, to see, and passio is to suffer in your body. Sight and touch defined this pilgrimage experience. Large architectural complexes developed to house this theater, as for instance the Constantinian Basilica, including the site of Golgotha and the Anastasis Rotunda, enclosing the rock where Christ's body was buried before his resurrection and ascension. Here, on particular feast days, cramped and dwarfed in this monumental architectural shell, the pilgrims huddled and waited. Their eyes fixed on the remnants of the cross, which were taken out from their glittering gold and silver box and held by the patriarch. The faithful could then line up and approach to kiss the wood, believing that the touch of their lips transmitted the holy energy, the same way that that Christ's body on the cross originally embedded sacred power in this very wood. It is this reciprocal, cyclical model. In this reciprocal, cyclical model, energy was constantly pumping and running, sought and given. At this locus sancta, touch and sight and hearing were orchestrated to produce a sense of divine presence, energy in the faithful. Apart from the direct touch of hands and lips to the source of power, the pilgrims were also given objects they could carry with them on their arduous and perilous journey home. These were secondary touch relics, like the oil of the true cross, which ebbed the moment the container was pressed to the wood. These flasks of prepackaged divine energy, created and sealed through touch, extended and ensured a continuous multi-location presence. It is essential to understand how sight, hearing, and touch structure the experience of Holy Land. I would not continue, however, with the ceremonies of Holy Land. Instead, I'll turn my attention to a latecomer on the map of holy sites, Syria. Starting in the mid-5th century, a cult to a special saint developed, the so-called stylite or column saint. These saints spent their life on top of a column, baked and desiccated by heat, drenched, beaten, and frozen by rain and winds for decades, meeting their death in the gradual weakening and putrefaction of their tired, immobilized limbs. It is the cult of the stylites that introduced smell as the most potent link to the divine, and this was accomplished through incense. To many of you, the word incense triggers the memory of sticks covered with dried substance, which when lit slowly burn, exuding a fragrant smoke. For Byzantium and the Orthodox world until today, incense comes in the form of irregular waxy beads covered in white powder. When placed in a metal trellis container and lit, these beads gradually disintegrate, leaving a trail of thick smoke, which gradually reifies into thick, immaterial column rising up in the air. Why was incense so important among the stylites? For Susan Harvey, who recently published a magisterial book on scent in late antiquity, these saints presented the final stage of absorption of late antique sensuality of pagan rituals into Christianity. On a practical level, incense counteracted the stench of disintegrated, worm-infested putrid during the lifetime of the saint. The perfume, as the oxymoron of stench, built the paradox on which faith could be established. Fragrance, as the sign of divine presence, legitimized the saint, presenting the stylite as a chosen human being, overshadowed by the spirit and grace. Harvey has argued, based on the surviving vitae of these saints, how the presence of incense progressively multiplied in the lives of a succession of three stylites, Simeon the Elder from the mid-5th century, Daniel in the 6th, early 6th, and Simeon the Younger, who died at the very end of the 6th century. Yet the intensity of these cults grew after the death of the saint. How do we explain incense then, when putrid and stench were no longer pressing? This question was pursued neither by Harvey, who studied the text, or by Gary Vickan, who explained the material remnants of these cults through the written vitae. Beyond the simple inversion of stench into fragrance, incense offers a sensual manifestation of a metamorphosis, transformation of substance, performed before the eyes and noses of the pilgrims. Matter was transfigured, infused with divinity, as the morphe, substance of fleshy waxy beads, became ethereal perfumes, perfumed smoke, it stacked into the shape of a column. This stilus, which is the Greek word for column, in turn reciprocated and reproduced the figure of the saint on a column. The same shape also elicited the belief of contact and reciprocation between terrestrial and celestial, a column rising up to connect the two. Lastly, the rising smoke manifested divine presence through fragrance. The disintegration of matter that paradoxically creates presence rather than absence, the emptying out of the divine into tangible scent. Smell was dramatized as an intense visual experience. Smell precipitates sight and induces the sense of sacred presence. This is exactly the principle governing the rituals promoted by stylite cults. Both the architectural remains of the sanctuary and the clay tokens distributed to the pilgrims have survived. Kalat al-Siman, the site of St. Simeon the Elder, is to the north of Antioch. Here the crowds of pilgrims gathered to see the column of the saint and received unbaked clay tokens with the imprinted figure of the saint. And this is the site of Kalat al-Siman, and at the very center, as you see in this crossing, is the column itself. And here are two tokens. They are of unbaked clay. The size of the smaller is the size of a quarter. The size of the other one, the slightly bigger one, is 4 centimeters. I'm sorry, I won't translate into inches, but hopefully you'll try to do that knowing that the smaller one is a quarter. And you can see here the backside of these objects. They have the imprint of the palm that was holding the clay as they were imprinting the ceiling, the intaglio on it. The tokens were referred by contemporaries as eulogia. This is a special, intensely packed word meaning blessing, consecration, consecrated bread, gift, and dispensation. On a second set of such objects, but coming from the site of the more recent saint, Saint Simeon the Younger, the word eulogion is part of the rim, and you can see it, this is on your right, at the very beginning of the outer rim are the Greek words eulogia. So I hope you see it. There is no way I could point. We are not allowed laser pointers. In this eulogia, we can trace the establishment of a cult predicated on the sense of smell. Their iconography drew the pilgrims in and offered the magic through which supernatural presence could be conjured up through incense. They functioned like doctor's pills. Their substance was sacred because it was land sanctified by the presence of the saint. It was clay taken from the bottom of the column, from the soil around the column. The saint and bust stands on his column. You can see here on the next one, the image at the center. Two angels place victory crowns on the head of the athlete of God. In the column's base, a pilgrim shakes a censer. And this is what you see at the central medallion at the right side, at the left side, the bottom left. Then I'm showing you the censer from the 6th century and then the slab again from the 6th or 7th century. In a variant of the same scene, we see the addition of a tiny vignette on the left side showing Christ's baptism. And I hope you're able to see it. It's on this side here. This juxtaposition of stylite with Christ is rhetorical and magical. First, it shows how the saint is a form of Christ, a perfect imitator. Just like the Holy Spirit descends on Christ, so too we are asked to imagine how it descends on his later disciple, the column saint. Similarly, just like the baptism conjures up the crowds of penitents coming to Jordan, so too, such large crowds were expected and projected at the sign of Saint Simeon. The two kneeling figures at the front of the column, this is on the right side, offer just such an example of pilgrims who raise their hands and eyes towards the imaginary saint. Finally, the image of John the Baptist conjures up the narrative of incense and presence. When his father, Zechariah, brought incense as gift to the temple to beseech for a child, he heard a voice of angels affirming that his request was heard. An incense burner from the 6th or 7th century attests to the power of this illusion. Here, the inscription written on the rim reads, "As you receive the incense of the holy prophet Zechariah, Lord, receive this incense," end of quote. Thus, the image of the angels at the top on the Eulogion, flanking the stylite saint, assures that the stylite is a channel to God, overshadowed by God and imbued with angelic response. A prayer to him will be efficient, and this prayer is understood through incense. Just like Zechariah prayed burning incense, so too the pilgrim was encouraged to do the same away from the sacred site. By holding the token, lighting up incense, and praying, he or she sensed in the fragrance the scent of sacred presence. It is through incense and smell that synesthesia was triggered. The smell of perfume elicited a vision of the saint. The visual vocabulary of Simeon the Elder's tokens present the matrix of these cult practices. This matrix is reproduced and reinforced in the tokens of his successor and competitor, Simeon the Younger of the Thaumaturgic Mountain. In his Vita, we read how the tokens were instrumental in precipitating the magical appearance of the saint away from his column and holy site. In Miracle 231, Saint Simeon the Younger gives a clay token to a father priest, one of whose children is sick. When the father refuses to depart from the sanctuary before his son is healed, the saint refers to his token and encourages the father with these words. I quote, "The power of God is everywhere. Take this eulogium of our dust, depart, and in the seal of our imprint, it is me you will see," end of quote. When the father returns home, another of his children falls sick. In this context, he is confident that the saint will appear to heal his child. After this, his son spontaneously cries out, I quote, "Saint Simeon, have mercy on me," and to his father, "Get up quickly and throw incense and pray, because the servant of God, Saint Simeon, stands before my eyes with his metal scepter and a chain, and everything is full of blazing fire," end of quote. Incense is equated to prayer, which in turn activates divine grace. This belief in the agency of clay tokens, incense, and prayer is revealed in the inscription of some of these objects proclaiming, and I read the inscription that is on the right side of the column. It says, "Receive this incense and give health to all," end of quote. The mnemonic power of these clay tokens is interlocked with magic. Incense carries the power of presence, for it conjures up presence. Now it becomes clear how the visual similitude of a column of smoke and a column of saint and column saint enforces the power of inducing presence through a stack of fragrant smoke. And so basically all these objects are like dormant magic. The moment you lit up incense, the saint could appear in front of you and you pray. So this is how the magic is unlocked, through incense and prayer. Smell activates sight, so that the faithful could experience the miraculous intervention of the saint any place in the world. Yet this is a particular sight, a transformed, metamorphosized vision, overshadowed by the Spirit. It is kenotic and eucharistic at the same time, an emptying of the divine into the world. In Greek, this phenomenon of inspirited, animated sight is captured in the word empsychos. The experience of the stylites was thus predicated on the model of Christ and the Eucharist. Just like bread and wine, metamorphosized, overshadowed by the Spirit into flesh and blood, so too the stylites appeared in the sense of smell. I will now turn to an 11th century Byzantium to explore another similar Eucharist model synesthetic experience of smell and sight. Four medieval texts draw our attention to an icon of the Virgin kept at the Vlaherna Monastery, the oldest and most important sanctuary of Mary in the city. The icon doesn't survive, nor does the sanctuary itself, so I'm showing you an icon from the 11th century from Italy, but it is a Byzantine icon, and because it has such a well-preserved metal revetment and shape, it will give you some sense of this 11th century object that is no longer there. Here on Fridays at the Vlaherna Church, a large crowd of people gathered to witness the liturgical reenactment of the mystery of the Incarnation. The focus was this icon of Mary, covered from the waist down with a veil. During the course of the liturgy, the veil lifted to reveal the image of Christ, of the Christ child on his mother's chest. I will discuss only one of the four texts. This is a Latin pilgrim's account dating to the second half of the 11th century and preserved in a 13th century manuscript at Tarragona. The text reads as follows. At the Vlaherna complex, there are two churches, a basilica and a small rotunda. The small rotunda is also made of marble. The two are linked so that one could easily pass from one to the other. In the small one, there is a holy and venerable gold icon of the Theotokos, holding the son whom she was blessed to bear. In connection with this icon, a famous miracle happens every week. Although different things are said about it by many people, I, however, have seen it with my own eyes, not once, but many times, so I'll take care to report it truthfully, adding no falsehood anywhere. This holy icon of the Theotokos is covered from the waist down by a veil attached on either side by two nails. Thus, half of the icon is visible from the waist up, that is, the bosom and the head. The other half is concealed from the waist down, covered, as I have said, by a silken veil. On the sixth day of the week, which is Friday, around sunset, as many people as possible gather at the aforementioned church, men and women, and also clergy and priests. And just as on Holy Sabbath at Easter in the city of Jerusalem, those who are present wait in hope of seeing the fire descending from above. In the same way, on the appointed day, the people of Constantinople stand in front of the holy icon, waiting and hoping that the veil would lift by the grace of God as usual. As the hour approaches in which the divine miracles ought to take place, they strike a wooden board to summon the congregation to the church. So at this signal, they all get gathered in the church in front of the holy icon of the Theotokos, the clergy singing and the laity praying. They piously call upon the great works of the omnipotent God to grant that the usual miracles be performed. You would see there people of both sexes in such numbers and feel such a crush of people that if you were there in the nude during winter, you would hardly be able to stand the heat. You would hear sweet-sounding strains of human voices celebrating the glory of the Theotokos. In addition, the priest, in the vestments he wears for celebrating Mass, goes around the altar and the holy icon several times with a golden censer full of incense. What more can I say? While the clergy is singing and the people are praying, the veil that covers half of the icon lifts up by the grace of God, showing the half of the image it has concealed before. End of quote. The usual miracle, synethes thavma, as the term refers, is a term that is interconnected with the Eucharist. This is the usual miracle. This illusion created both through language, through the appropriation of the term, legitimizes the new ritual as a grand, public, iconic reconfiguration and enactment of the Holy Sacrament. Moreover, the lifting of the veil, which uncovers the image of Christ, gives a vision of the Incarnation, of the Logos descending and acquiring a visible form. The figure of Mary thus becomes a living testament to the descent of grace. She is Keheritomeni, overshadowed, pregnant with grace. The magic is precipitated through heat, crowding, singing, praying, and finally incense. It is the golden incense with which the priests walks around the icon that precipitates the lifting of the veil. It is again incense that stimulates and activates the presence in the image becoming alive. Just like the tokens of the stylites, which were activated through scent and the burning of incense and prayer, so too burning incense and prayer imbues the icon with a living presence. Smell is the trigger of the metamorphic vision. It is itself metamorphic, transforming matter into smoke, an ascending ladder to the divine. Both the pilgrimage sites of late antiquity and the Constantinopolitan special icons of the Virgin conjured up presence by replicating the Eucharistic ritual. Earlier on in my Art Bulletin article, The Performative Icon, I drew a distinction between synesthesis and synesthesia, arguing that Byzantium was much more involved in the simultaneity of senses rather than in chain activations. I call this phenomenon synesthesis, simultaneity of senses, using the Greek word, although there is no Greek Byzantine correspondent in text, but they do speak about the five senses when they speak about spiritual experience. And I coined it because I felt constrained by synesthesia. Yet the more I work with the medieval Greek texts and objects, the more I become aware of the coexistence of concepts of synesthesis and synesthesia. In fact, the Byzantines were acutely aware of synesthesia, this phenomenon of one activated sense which induces without stimulus a sensation in another. Byzantium carefully choreographed the experience of the sacred around the chain trigger of intertwined senses. By endorsing Aristotle, the Byzantines considered smell and taste as animalist, base senses, while sight the superior in the human sensorium. Sight was the first to be triggered as the faithful entered the ritual space and the last to be reintroduced at the moment of culmination, the Eucharist. Just before the reception of the Eucharist, the faithful heard the words, I quote, "Taste and see that God is good." This is Psalm 33, verse 8, according to the Septuagint. The moment they felt the taste, smell, and texture of the bread and wine in their mouths, sight was reactivated, but now it was the paradoxical empsychos, inspirited, embodied, and overshadowed by grace, sight. Synesthesia was cultivated in Byzantium through the ritual of the Eucharist. All the other spiritual experiences drew on the model of the Eucharist and became legitimized through it. Thank you.
Thank you, Becerra. What we're going to do is to have Kevin Dan speak next, and then there will be time after both presentations to have questions from all of you and also to have a dialogue between the speakers. Our next speaker, Kevin Dan, has as many skills and educational backgrounds as Becerra has languages. He received his BA in biology and natural history, his MA in geography, his PhD from Rutgers University in American history and environmental history. He has produced six books, again on a wide-ranging topics. Most recently, still in manuscript form, is The Life of Henry David Thoreau. The book that got us interested in having him here is called Bright Colors, Falsely Seen, Synesthesia, and the Search for Transcendental Knowledge. It was published in 1998. I did note that one of his books is called The Naturalist Myth, and it may, in fact, be Kevin as we heard last night, somewhat of the devil's advocate, who will begin to talk about the synesthesia myth. But we'll see what he has to say. I'm as much in the dark as you are, since the paper he was going to give, apparently, he has jettisoned for some more spontaneous remarks. So, Kevin, welcome to the podium.
So, what I'm really trying to do is, you know, in California is the place that has celebrated synesthesia as a participatory right, as an enactment, right? And here we are already objectifying, analyzing, distanced. And we want to collapse the distance. That's very hard to do. But that has been what has been alive. And California is the place where that's lived the most powerfully, right? When I wear a tie-dyed shirt, people think Haight-Ashbury, right? You know, and in the 60s, synesthesia equaled psychedelic. So what I'm going to do right now is to show you a series of images. Oh, before I do that, I should say, who is a synesthete? Thank you, and welcome.
Wait, is anybody else on?
Yes, introduce yourselves to each other.
Hi, I'm Jim. I'm a synesthete. No, not an academic. I'm not from the and I just discovered that there's such a thing as synesthesia. So I thought I was retarded before that.
Well,
everybody saw colors as numbers and letters as colors, and I only learned that I was unusual when I was in college 30 years ago and read Nabokov's Speak Memory.
Ah, okay. Well, now I know, Bisara, you and I will not be deluged with questions. All the questions will now go to the real synesthetes, which would be be a wonderful thing. Now, how many people in the room know a synesthete? Okay. Wonderful. Those of you who don't, this is your opportunity, right? So what I'd like to do is just, in a moment, Professor Ramachandran is going to really bring us into the inner world and workings of some aspects of synesthesia. And we have this bona fide, that was the term that Jeanette used this morning. We had idiopathic and perceptual, all these terms. What my talk was originally called was the synesthetic rainbow's elusive pot of gold. And I realized I was going to talk more about what synesthesia has been mistaken to be. In other words, more negation and not affirmation. And it seemed to me that I would like to go right into affirmation and say what it is, especially because my friend Sarah has traveled all the way up from L.A. And let's get into it. And because we have such a short time, what I've done is I'm going to have music playing, and I'm going to just have to go as fast as I can in commenting on these slides. That will keep me. And my friend Jeremiah McLean's music is behind here. If we went back to the 18th century, this is an invention of tradition. Oh, you know what? No, let's do this way. Let's do it as a slideshow. What we have is perennially an invention of tradition going back and inventing certain figures and phenomena as synesthesia. This goes all the way back to the early 18th century, and the colored harpsichord of Louis-Bertrand Castel, or color organ. But at the turn of the century, 1901, Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater's thought forms, this production of the Theosophical movement, who said, oh, you know, when we hear music like Wagner's Meistersinger, or the next one being Felix Mendelssohn's songs, there are these extraordinary colored visions that are produced. And the clairvoyant, the one who has mastered certain forms of meditation to contact higher worlds, is able to see these forms and colors. And here, of course, the archetypal synesthete, who's not a synesthete at all, Kandinsky, This is fragment 2 for composition 7 from 1913, right after Concerning the Spiritual and Art was published in 1912. This one, Fugue, 1914. As you know, many of Kandinsky's canvases have musical titles, and he was obsessed with this idea of the interaction of sound and sight. This is Leopold Sauvage, Rhythm Coloré, from 1914, and the first attempt to begin to use the medium of film to evoke a kind of synesthetic experience. Mikhail Matyushin, his painterly composition from 1918. And here you see already the psychedelic sense, right? Before the psychedelic era. Georgia O'Keeffe's Pink and Blue from 1919. I included this one because some of these are compositions, Arthur Dove's Swing, a Louis Armstrong song inspired this from 1938. These have made their way into many contemporary exhibitions on visual music, synesthesia in art. This is Oscar Fischinger, who again experimented with film. And Fischinger, you might know, having worked on the original Fantasia, and then Disney sort of left behind the abstraction. He wasn't comfortable with that. This is Thomas Wilfred from the late 50s and early 60s. Again, the bringing of music and color into an experience from the film medium. John Whitney and his brother James Whitney, they also trying to work with film as a way to create a kind of evocation of synesthesia. And then finally, let's get to Haight-Ashbury. This is the Joshua Light Show, about 1968. Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And all of that was preceded by this long history of fascination with synesthesia. And of course, Solomon Shereshevsky was the darling of the Haight-Ashbury culture because he was a walking hallucination, right? He had multimodal synesthesia. Wouldn't that be great to have? So now we've left behind pseudo-synesthesia. This is my friend Carol Steen's vision, the first time she ever painted one of her, she's a synesthete, color-hearing synesthete, and this is a series of her canvases. This one was inspired by Angélique Kidjo's Wei Wei. This one, Clocks by Coldplay. This one's called More Freshly Green. Santana's Aduma. And finally, Clouds Rise Up. This is inspired by the notes of a Japanese wooden flute. And as Carol says, and many other synesthetes or painters say, they can always go back to the canvas and put the music back on, and they have the same visions in front of them. A new friend of mine, Jane McKay, British artist, painter. This is a series of her canvases that she's painted of her visions inspired by or evoked by Rachmaninoff's Vespers. And another new friend, Marcia Smilak, who does this extraordinary work with photography to evoke her visions. And she, of course, when people attend to their own synesthesia, they find other layers. And what Marcia's found over this time is now sight produces sound. So she would look at this and say, you know, this is a flute, this is a cello, doing this kind of a run. Dreams and synesthesia have interesting intertwining. She took this photograph because she had dreamed it a night or two previously, and she snapped the shutter when all of a sudden she saw what she had seen in her dream. My friend David Powell, having read my book, he decided this was his vision of the very confused world of colored vowels and consonants. Vladimir Nabokov's, one of the editions of Speak Memory, has colored letters on the front. I couldn't find a picture of this. So this is a book done by an artist who took Nabokov's letters and his alphabet, his color-hearing alphabet, and made a little abecedarium out of them. So, in showing you visual material, I don't want to slight the literary arts. And if I were doing this negation type of talk, I would talk about how, really, Arthur Rimbaud, his poem Voyelles, is the one that kind of launches a kind of popular fascination with synesthesia. But I'd like to introduce these words, this little poem written by Nabokov. They come from the mouth of his character John Shade in his novel Pale Fire. My picture book was at an early age the painted parchment papering our cage, mauve rings around the moon, blood orange sun, twinned iris, and that rare phenomenon, the iridule, when beautiful and strange in a bright sky above a mountain range, one opal cloudlet in an oval form reflects the rainbow of a thunderstorm, which in a distant valley has been staged, for we are most artistically caged. I think we all want to be artistically caged, and that's why we envy the synesthete. We are artistically caged, and now this impulse to saying we're all synesthetes, which has been very, very persuasively and eloquently brought forward by Professor Ramachandran and others. So as I drifted off to sleep last night, the words that rang in my ear were, you got to bring biology into it somehow. Remember that? So amen and hallelujah. Bring biology into it. It may not be the kind of biology you were thinking of, Anne. I just want to say this. I will go to the mat. I'll go to the mat to say that Dr. George Sachs, who wrote this dissertation on his own albinism and his sister's albinism in 1812, published it in Latin. It was translated about a dozen years later into German. He was the first synesthete. It was the first report. It's the first what we're calling bona fide, idiopathic, perceptual, whatever you want to call, like our two synesthetes in the, it's this broad, broad spectrum. But he definitely had a form of synesthesia, as did his sister. And last night, was it Robert who had that very, very emotionally charged question about whether, since synesthetes in the 19th and 20th century often were looked at as freaks, did they look at these mystics who were evoking multimodal experience as freaks also? I forget exactly the words he used, but think of being in the early 19th century having this extraordinary phantasmagoria of the senses and also being an albino. But there is a hint for us. One of the great mysteries of synesthesia for me has always been this extraordinary confluence of very strange, deep, deep mysteries about the human being. Hypernesia, right? Not just Shereshevsky, but in so many different forms, this deep, deep memory capacity that synesthetes often have. Albinism. There are a lot of interesting cases of albinos with synesthesia. That's worth looking into, it seems to me. Eideticism. In the late 19th and early 20th century, it was very, very common for all the psychologists to have their eyes and ears tuned for people who had so-called photographic memory, which is a false privileging of the sense of sight, because, as with Vladimir Nabokov, they had essentially a multimodal sensory experience when these photographic images appear to them. Blindness. We have Thomas Cutsforth, the extraordinary graduate student out in Oregon who in the 20s devised a whole marvelous protocol, research protocol, and other individuals. Savant abilities, lightning calculators, prodigious musical and artistic savants. And then finally, we're in California, I gotta say it, and Ray, amen and hallelujah to you.
paranormal powers. Clairvoyance. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, at the end of the 19th century, in the early 20th century, before behaviorism came in, you could study that stuff, you know, and they didn't, you know, move away from you at the lunch table. So each and every one of these mysteries demands that we bring biology into it. Absolutely. There's the geographic dimension. There's an ethnic dimension. Is it at all significant that the first appearance of color hearing was from a German family? The people who studied synesthesia in the early 20th century from Marburg, the sort of proto-fascists, would have said yes. And that's why Goethe as synesthete, you know, was invented as synesthete. These great German artists all became, because they saw it as a form of privileged perception, the new. Because this was all about escaping from the old and reaching into the world of the new. A new clairvoyance that lay on the horizon, and synesthetes offered this promise of escaping the bounds of the sensible into the supersensible. And what about these gifted synesthetes that are Russian? Interesting, you know, Nabokov, Solomon Shereshevsky. The ones, the real extreme examples that stick out. When I wrote my book 10 years ago, I was under a kind of an impulse thinking that if we could find out if this was new, it would lead modern Western culture into more seriously contemplating what the esoteric traditions have known, both East or West, which is that human consciousness evolves. It's not a genetic process. It's a spiritual process. And in the esoteric Christian tradition, the Sophianic tradition, it's the Slavic race that will be the sixth post-Atlantean, right? Philadelphia, out of John's revelation. And what does biology have to say about the coincidence of synesthesia and eideticism with both extreme intelligence? And we know now intelligence is, a broad spectrum of talents and possibilities and faculties, but also extreme lack of capacity. And in the early days of this, it was seen that if you could see things that others didn't see, that meant that you were somehow better. You know, it was a privileging, even if you didn't think that this was seeing into the spiritual world, which is what Kandinsky and his crowd and the people in the 60s, when they dropped acid, they were trying to storm heaven, right? That's what they were doing. So I might be out of time by now. Am I? Yeah. So I'll do is just say to reinforce that I hope that we will, in conversation, entertain questions about this intersection of synesthesia with some other deep mysteries too, and see if that can bring us to some new insights as well. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.